Welcome to Stirling Square, City's home in the West End. My name is Ben Story. I'm the head of UK investment banking at City. And we are delighted to host the launch of the Centre for European Reform's report, How to Build a Modern European Union. At City, we have a very keen interest in developments in the EU. City was initially attracted to London in 1902 because of the historic role of the city as a global trading centre. In recent years, the UK's deep ties with Europe and access to the single market have been key factors supporting our investment and our exports. In addition to our proud British heritage, we are also staunch Europeans. City has operations in a further 22 European member states, and we employ 38,000 people across Europe. Our London HQ acts as a key resource for our clients throughout the region. To us, the benefits of EU membership are manifest. Therefore, we encourage broad discussion based on facts rather than a narrow exchange based on sentiment. Policies and actions that support investment, SMEs, and a reduction in youth unemployment will be particularly potent when it comes to making the case for the EU. Without further ado, it is with great pleasure that I introduce Charles Grant, Director of the Centre for European Reform.
Thank you very much, Ben. Thanks to you and your colleagues for hosting. We've already taken this report to Paris, Berlin, Warsaw and Washington for launch events. Delighted to finally do one in London with the Deputy Prime Minister. Reform matters for a number of reasons in the EU. One is that it's going to be very hard to persuade the British to stay in it in the long run if it's not reformed. And the second point is it's not just about the British and keeping them happy. Unless the EU shows it can adapt and evolve and respond to new challenges, then Euroscepticism will grow and become increasingly powerful across the EU. So we really do have to reform it. But one word of caution on this in the context for the British and other debates. I don't believe there's going to be a new EU treaty in time for 2017 and the Prime Minister's proposed referendum in that year. I don't think there's going to be one because most governments don't want one. The Germans would like a new treaty, ideally, but to do very small, minor things to adjust the Eurozone's governance arrangements. And what they say to me is, well, we'd like it to be a treaty of 28, a whole EU treaty, but if the British make unreasonable demands, then we'll go below 28 and do an intergovernmental treaty of a smaller number of countries, as they've done a number of times already. So this means, I think, that whatever Britain asks for, whatever reforms we try and achieve in the next few years, we should be modest in our ambitions. Doesn't mean we can't get reform. To get reform, you need friends and allies. And if we have friends and allies, we can get some of the reforms outlined in this report, which we'll discuss today. I know that the Deputy Prime Minister understands the needs for friends and allies in order to achieve reforms. Delighted he's here. Nick, over to you.
Well, thank you, Charles, and thank you, Ben, and thank you all for being here amplify the wisdom of this excellent CER report on such an important theme. And it comes at a very timely moment, this event. We've got a number of weeks now before the European elections towards the latter end of May. And in the time-honoured convention was that British politicians and British political parties would talk about everything but Europe in European elections. I think this year it is going to be quite different, and I think it's a good thing. I think for the first time that I can certainly remember, Europe will be the subject of the European elections because of the profound forces at play within the European Union and, of course, because of the increasing polarisation of the debate within the United Kingdom. And I certainly am going to take the opportunity to speak out in favour of a pro-British, pro-European, pro-reform agenda at every opportunity between now and those European elections and beyond. And I will take every opportunity I can, and I would urge all those of you from all parties and none who are committed. Whatever misgivings we might have about this individual decision or that individual person or institution, those who are committed to Britain's enduring membership of the European Union, I hope we will all take the opportunity to explode some of the distorting and pernicious myths that abound in this debate. And the one I'd like to focus on today, which is the focus of the excellent report from CER, is this. I think for too long there has been an assumption that only those who dislike the European Union or want to yank us out of the European Union or are antagonistic towards the European Union have a monopoly on the zeal to reform the European Union. And that if you are for Britain's membership of the European Union, somehow you are oblivious to any of its failings, you are indifferent to any of its weaknesses, and you are lax in wanting to promote any reform within the European Union. I think the truth is precisely the reverse, and I want to illustrate and prove that to you today. I think pro-Europeans are the real European reformers today. I think you can only deliver reform within the European Union by being committed to Britain's enduring membership of it. And I think that, by contrast, those who want to either distance or semi-exit or fully exit this European club are in the weakest position of all to stand up for Britain's interests by reforming the European Union, both economically and in policy terms, in a way which suits and promotes Britain's interests. Now, as if to try and illustrate that in the most melodramatic form, it's worth, for instance, just dwelling for a moment on what the most anti-European party of all, the UK Independence Party, has actually done to promote Britain's interests and to promote reform in Europe. You would have thought that if your worldview is based on the idea that it is bad for Britain for us to be part of the European Union, a party such as the UK Independence Party would have used its birth in the European Parliament to find every possible opportunity to promote reforms that create British jobs, that enhance British security, and that enhance the British way of life within a European Union. Yet the record shows almost precisely the reverse. UKIP leaders don't turn up to vote in the European Parliament most of the time. Nigel Farage hasn't tabled a single amendment, not a single amendment, to the flow of legislation passing through the European Parliament since July 2009. They abstained extraordinarily for a party that also claims to be in favour of wider and more open trade across the world. They abstained on a vote on the EU-US trade agreement that is being thrashed out right now, which is worth up to £10 billion a year to the British economy in the future. They voted against new European mobile phone roaming regulations, which have helped cut the costs of SMS and telephone calls and data charges across the European Union. And they also opposed, in my view, almost most spectacularly of all, the European arrest warrant that has led to the deportation and extradition of over 4,000 criminal suspects, including Hussein Osman, one of the failed 2005 London bombers. So, you know, I will now turn in a minute to the record of pro-European reform. But if one were to look at whether those who are most staunchly opposed to the status quo, whether they have taken the opportunity that they have to push for the kind of reforms that I think most people accept are necessary in order to boost growth, deepen complete the single market and create job security for millions of Britons in the future. Far from taking that opportunity, they have shunned every opportunity to do so and have not only let down, therefore, the case for reforming the European Union, but that they have let down the British interest within the heart of the European Union. That is, by the way, one of the reasons why I'm so delighted that myself and Nigel Farage, myself as the leader of the party of In, in the European debate, and Nigel Farage as the leader of the party of Out, will be holding these debates on radio and television towards the end of this month from the beginning of next, so that people can see what the choices are available to them come the European elections, And I think that choice is increasingly becoming a fundamental one about whether we remain in the European Union and push for its reform, or whether we yank ourselves out of the European Union with, in my view, the disastrous costs for millions of people's livelihoods in this country. People can judge for themselves, people can vote for themselves, but I hope through those debates we'll be able to really illuminate what the choices are for the country as a whole. What is then the record of those who have sought to reform from within? And again, I think it's worth spelling this out, because there is an unchallenged assumption that for those of us who are committed to our continued membership of the European Union, somehow the case for reform is not as vigorously or as aggressively made. The record actually shows something quite different. Notwithstanding the differences that clearly exist between my party and my coalition coalition partners, the Conservative Party, on Europe, actually when we have joined forces and argued a positive case for reform from within the European Union, rather than with sort of one foot out and one foot in the European Union, we have a demonstrably successful record in doing so. Whether it is cutting the overall European Union budget by around £30 billion, and yet at the same time reallocating a lot of European Union budget resources to infrastructure, research, transport and energy, exactly the kind of value-added areas of cross-border expenditure which the EU budget should focus on. Whether it is, and this is something that a Liberal Democrat minister, Ed Davey, took the lead on when he was in the business department, whether it is finally agreeing an exemption for over 100,000 of the UK's smallest businesses and micro-businesses across the European Union from new European Union regulations, saving small businesses up to £390 million a year in administrative costs, whether it is both promoting and completing a number of new trade agreements around the globe, South Korea, Colombia, Peru, the conclusion of the negotiations with Canada and Singapore. I mean, just dwell on one of them. Since the South Korea agreement was reached, British exports to that booming economy have doubled by almost £2 billion. Again, that's something we've done by being committed to our membership of the European Union and working for those reforms and changes within it. And perhaps most kind of visibly of all, the fact that we have finally, after years and years of painstaking negotiations, not by threatening to quit, not by being absent in votes, not by sort of, you know, stamping our foot petulantly on the sidelines, but by working painstakingly in building alliances with other countries and promoting reform, we have presided over and led the process of the biggest overhaul and reform of the common fisheries policy in a generation, such that we're now finally banning this woefully wasteful practice of discards, throwing dead fish back into the sea. And there's a landmark process of devolution of power in the common fisheries policy, so that day-to-day decisions will increasingly be taken by regional advisory councils, including fishermen and scientists. Look, there are many other examples, but I just think those are good examples of things that have happened, that have been done, that have been successfully negotiated, of reform that's been successfully agreed by Britain leading, not leaving, by Britain leading, not complaining. And so I think it is immensely important, when you contrast those records of inaction from anti-Europeans and reform from pro-Europeans, that we should be assertive in saying over and over again is that if you believe in the European Union but don't believe it's perfect, and I don't think anybody believes it's perfect, I certainly don't. I remember when I was working in Brussels, it took 15 years to agree a chocolate directive. Anything that takes a decade and a half to define chocolate is an imperfect institution. By the way, I think Westminster is imperfect. I think Whitehall's imperfect. I haven't exactly succeeded in reforming it quite as I'd hoped, but to be committed to an institution is to be committed to its reform. And that is what our record shows. That is what is embodied in this excellent report. And that is why we should, as those of us in all parties and none committed to our continued membership of the European Union, should not be shy in promoting our record of reform. Looking to the future, my own priorities for reform are really in three priority areas. Firstly, obviously, boosting jobs and growth in Britain, promoting the economic reforms which are so indispensable to our economic well-being. Secondly, improving, streamlining, making more accountable the way in which decisions are taken, the way in which European Union institutions work. And thirdly, cutting and withdrawing unnecessary and meddlesome red tape. Just a few words on each. There are many ways in which we can build upon the fact that over 3 million jobs are dependent in one way or another in our country on our place within the world's largest borderless single market. I've mentioned earlier the importance of using the muscle of the kind of collective clout of the European Union to continue to negotiate and agree new trade agreements with other major economies around the world. That is a very important driver of future growth, most notably, but not exclusively, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is being negotiated at the moment. I was talking to the commissioner who's responsible for those negotiations, Karel de Gucht, just last evening, and he was telling me that actually better progress is being made in these early stages than he had feared. I mean, I think there'll be many bumps along the road, but it's very important we remain committed to that. But I'll tell you what I think actually the biggest emphasis needs to be, and in a sense it's in the least glamorous part of European Union policymaking. It's simply completing the single market. Far too many people think the single market's done. It's done and dusted. Lord Cofield produced his report, we passed the legislation. Margaret Thatcher passed the Single European Act, worth observing, the largest transfer of sovereignty ever from this country to the European Union. And yet it is still a job unfinished. It is still a work in progress. If we were simply to complete the single market in services, by some independent estimates, EU GDP would rise by 1.6% in the coming years. If we were to complete the digital single market, where I think there is particularly fruitful potential for the United Kingdom to do well out of the completion of that, some estimates suggest that EU GDP would increase by 4% over the next 10 years. That is astonishing. If we were to complete the energy single market, still not complete, still balkanised by too many vested interests, too many protectionist instincts by governments across the European Union. Again, some independent estimates suggest that would bring electricity prices down for consumers by 13%. So I think there are many things we need to do, but we mustn't forget the importance of completing the job we've started. We haven't finished that job yet. And I think the emphasis placed on that in the report by the Centre for European Reform is exactly right. Secondly, ensuring that we've got better institutional arrangements. There are many facets to this. The Centre for European Reform report, for instance, places particular emphasis on restructuring the European Commission into a sort of hierarchy of commissioners, streamlining it. It's become a bit of a sprawling institution. You need a clearer sense of who's responsible for what and at what sort of level of seniority within the Commission. I strongly agree with that. I think it's going to be quite difficult to get that agreed, but I strongly agree with that impulse. And I'm sure I speak on behalf of, if not on other issues, I speak on behalf of Caroline Lucas on this one, that I think ex-MEPs such as Caroline and myself and many other current MEPs, I think, would be delighted if we could finally scrap the nonsense of this monthly migration of all MEPs at the cost of £150 million a year of MEPs travelling down to Strasbourg. It's a complete nonsense, a total anachronism. It should have been got rid of a long time ago. I strongly agree with the suggestion in the CER pamphlet that the Lisbon arrangements, in which national parliaments can, in effect, sort of raise the alarm if a certain number of national parliaments raise what is called a kind of yellow card and say, look, we're not happy with this Commission proposal, the Commission should then heed that advice. I agree with the CER's instinct that we should actually make that more muscular, strengthen it, so in effect turning a yellow card into a red card. So there are many other suggestions, but these are all suggestions which I think are immensely important in order to constantly challenge and update, streamline and modernise our institutions. Third and finally, regulation. First and foremost, I should add, the idea, this sort of cardboard cutout caricature, that the only place which produces unwelcome or misplaced red tape is Brussels. I can tell you after 4 years in London, in Whitehall rather, in government, I have, if I had any misgivings about that myth, I certainly do now. I've discovered that our own government machine is just as capable of applying excessively meddlesome regulation as anybody else. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be exacting in seeking to eliminate from the statute book, roll back, withdraw and reverse existing European Union regulations, or indeed proposed ones, which simply don't make sense, which are disproportionate, or have passed their sell-by date. Now, there are many, many ways you can do that. I talked earlier about the importance of the exemption for small businesses, a very important one. As I say, very proud that that was negotiated by a Liberal Democrat minister in this coalition government. I believe we should keep some of the opt-outs, for instance, in the working time directive, which I think, if we were to change that, that would not work well for many British employees. And I think we need to constantly press the European Commission, which is, of course, the engine of any new proposals, to stress test all new proposals against their impact, and to apply sunset clauses wherever possible, so that things don't just remain in perpetuity on the statute, but when they don't need to. So, pro-Europeans, I mean, I'm pro-European not because I love the European Union, because I'm pro-British. I think it's just so flamingly obvious that in a footloose, fancy-free world where there are all sorts of threats and challenges and opportunities, we can't possibly deal with on our own. We can't go after criminals across borders unless we do so in cooperation with other countries together. We can't possibly deal with the great ebb and flow of the economic forces of globalisation unless we work together in our own European backyard. We can't secure ourselves against the threats of climate change, a quintessentially cross-border problem, unless we work with other countries. I just think, take it as a given that in this modern world you get more done together with others than you do on your own. But we need to make that case. We need to remake that case. That is why I'm so keen to take the opportunity of these European elections to remake the case as the leader of the party of in. That's why I'm delighted that there will be such a clear debate between that choice and the choice of leaving the European Union altogether. But as we make that case, we must wrestle back from the anti-European propagandists this idea that you can only reform the European Union by being implacably opposed to it. I believe the record shows you can only reform the European Union by being implacably in favour of Britain's continued membership of the European Union. Thank you very much for listening to me.